Thanks for joining Sap Alone Nerds, a coastal science podcast. I'm your host, Corinne.
And I'm your host, Brittany. And we work at the National Estuarine Research Reserve, or NEAR, on Sapelo Island, a Georgia barrier island.
Today we'll be talking about one of the most important contributions to wildlife habitat and community resilience that homeowners can choose to have on their properties. Living shorelines!
That's right, Brittany. Living shorelines are an innovative way to protect our coastlines from erosion, while also providing a habitat for wildlife and improving water quality.
So, what exactly defines a living shoreline?
That can be a little technical depending on where you're located. But here in coastal Georgia, as defined by the Coastal Resources Division of the DNR, a living shoreline is an erosion control technique that maintains or enhances the natural connectivity and processes between the land-water interface and is constructed using the strategic placement of mostly native materials to protect estuarine shorelines, absorb wave and tidal energy, and enhance coastal habitats. Living shorelines do not incorporate hardened vertical structures such as timber, sheet pile, vinyl, concrete, or etc., as determined by the department.
Yeah, that sounds pretty technical. Basically, a living shoreline is a stabilization method where instead of bulkheads, there's graded land that leads into the water, creating a progressive edge that is covered with native plants. And here in Georgia, oyster material can be placed on the lower half to recruit new oysters and further stabilizing the bank and create habitat.
The primary goal of a living shoreline is to stabilize the shoreline to reduce erosion, while avoiding engineering designs like bulkheads that hinder or disrupt the natural connections between aquatic environments and adjacent uplands. Secondary goals include the preservation of tidal waters, sediment control, increasing natural plant communities, and providing protection from sea level rise.
Absolutely, and living shorelines are becoming increasingly popular. Currently in Georgia, where NOAA estimates that we have almost 3,000 miles of tidal shoreline within our 100-mile coast, we have only about 12 living shoreline projects, with three possible future projects. Now, why so few? Well, that is something that UGA Marine Extension and Georgia Sea Grant has been looking into through IRIS, or the Institute for Resilience Infrastructure Systems. In several studies, they have been looking to understand why more people are not putting in living shorelines and instead choosing bulkheads. In the 50s and 60s, there was a lot of coastal development, but not a lot of appreciation for the long-term impacts on the environment that this development might cause. This led to an unfortunate tendency to install bulkheads, or what is known as hard armoring, which are intended to protect property owners from erosion and storm damage, but instead they really cause further erosion problems for neighbors and eventually fail, leading to costly repairs. Not to mention that bulkheads affect the ability of marshes to migrate as sea level rises. These hard armoring techniques have caused huge issues across our coast, and many states have been looking into ways to prevent hard armoring from being the first choice for contractors and engineers when faced with shoreline stabilization in low to mid energy environments where they have seen success with living shorelines the most.
That's right. And one of the benefits of living shorelines over bulkheads is that they can be customized to meet the needs of homeowners and businesses. They're constructed using native materials such as plants and oysters, as well as biodegradable coconut fiber core logs, and are designed to mimic the natural shoreline. Because of this, one of the main benefits of living shorelines is that they provide a habitat and access for wildlife. They're much more effective at providing natural habitat than traditional bulkheads or seawalls, which are actually a barrier for marine life. Oyster reefs provide habitat to young fish and create crevices for numerous species of beneficial organisms. Given that living shorelines are suitable for brackish and marine waters particularly, the oysters provide food, habitat, and prevent erosion along our estuary's borders.
Also, living shorelines provide a natural buffer between land and the water, which helps to reduce the impacts of storms and tidal surges. Like you said, they help to stabilize the shoreline by reducing erosion, which, while a natural process in estuarine systems, can be big trouble for homeowners living on the water. Living shorelines prevent this erosion by redirecting the water in a natural way versus just blocking the water the way hard armoring does. Living shorelines actually absorb the impact, due to the ground being able to absorb water over time and repair itself when damaged. Living shorelines are also an important tool for improving water quality. The oysters on living shorelines help to filter out pollutants from stormwater runoff, which can help to protect the health of our local waterways.
Yep, and it's these living organisms on a living shoreline that also help to mitigate the effects of climate change by absorbing carbon dioxide and reducing the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. A recent study by NOAA investigated the amount of carbon stored in salt marsh sediments and compared storage rates in marshes of different ages in North Carolina's Newport River estuary. They found that approximately 75 grams of carbon were sequestered per square meter per year. The 124 living shorelines in North Carolina store enough carbon to offset 64 metric tons of carbon dioxide annually, the pollution equivalent of burning 7,500 gallons of gasoline. Conversion of even 10% of North Carolina's 850 miles of shoreline to living shoreline would result in an additional annual carbon dioxide benefit of 870 metric tons, the pollution equivalent of using more than 100,000 gallons of gasoline. The carbon sequestered and subsequently stored in coastal wetland sediments is known as coastal blue carbon. Acre for acre, salt marsh meadows can store 2 to 3 times as much carbon over the course of a year as mature tropical forests.
That's crazy. With Georgia having one of the nation's most pristine coasts, you would think that hard armoring isn't a problem here. And compared to North Carolina or Florida, you might be right. But recent studies found that 23% of our coast is hard armored, with Chatham County and Bryan County having the most shoreline parcels that were hard armored when they could be living shorelines. Not only would living shorelines help the environment, but living shorelines could save taxpayers a lot of money in these counties, since they typically cost less than bulkheads and revetments. While upfront costs can be similar, living shorelines are relatively easy to maintain. They require regular pruning and weeding, but other than that, they are largely self-sustaining. This is way easier than the typical bulkheads, which, as we said, fail over time and lead to increased maintenance costs. Also, homeowners who invest in living shorelines may be eligible for grants and other financial assistance from local and state governments.
That's right, and living shorelines are not only beneficial to homeowners, but also for the local economy. They provide habitat for commercial and recreational fish, which can support the fishing industry.
And there are many different types of living shorelines that homeowners can choose from, depending on their needs and preferences and their location. Not to mention that living shorelines can also be aesthetically pleasing, adding to the natural beauty of our coastlines and improving our values for our homes.
To help us talk a little more about the specific projects in Georgia is a familiar guest.
You may remember Megan Angelina from our previous episode, What Are Water Words? Megan is a wetland biologist with the Coastal Resource Division and is responsible for the Living Shoreline Program here in coastal Georgia.
Hi, Brittany and Corinne. Glad to be back.
So, Megan, can you talk to us a little bit about some of the Living Shoreline projects in Georgia?
Of course. So, the first two pilot Living Shoreline projects in Georgia were constructed in 2010 on Sapelo Island. Like many of the 10 other Living Shoreline projects, the shorelines were graded to appropriate slopes, and oyster bags were placed and native vegetation was planted along their extents. We've learned a lot about living shorelines since then as it relates to materials and engineering, and also costs are changing, climate conditions are changing. So an example is that oyster shell is becoming limited and therefore very expensive in areas of the southeast. So we've started to turn to other materials that recruit oysters like Fleximat. Fleximat is a large mat that's rolled out over the shoreline, and it's made up of concrete nodes with spaces in between to plant native vegetation. The concrete nodes provide a surface for new oysters to recruit, and then the root systems of the native vegetation further stabilize the shoreline. Fleximat is now used in about 3 projects on the coast, and it's becoming more common in new projects that are being designed. Many of the projects are on remote barrier islands, but still some are located on the mainland or on islands accessible by car. The Cannons Point Living Shoreline on St. Simon's Island is one of those projects that's accessible to the public when the preserve is open on Saturdays, Sundays, and Mondays between 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. This particular shoreline that was constructed in 2015 got an early introduction to 2 major hurricanes, Irma and Matthew. The Spartina alterniflora that was adjacent to the living shoreline was battered down, But the spartina that was a part of the living shoreline that was planted behind the oyster bags stood untouched after the storms because it was protected by the oyster bags and its new recruits that created a sort of natural breakwater. With the completion of about a dozen living shorelines on the coast, we're continuously trying to spread the word and encourage living shorelines where they're appropriate. The Coastal Resources Division also facilitates the Georgia Living Shorelines Work Group, which is a small group of stakeholders focused on moving living shorelines forward through current projects and lessons learned. We're also currently working to establish living shoreline standards and best management practices to give guidance to professionals and homeowners considering the option.
It seems like there's a lot of effort going into making sure living shorelines are successful. What are some challenges property owners can face when it comes to choosing between living shorelines and hard armoring techniques?
I think the main thing is that a lot of people are familiar with the idea of hardened techniques, and with a living shoreline seeing quote-unquote nothing besides a graded shoreline and vegetation can be psychologically tough for someone who's used to having a physical barrier blocking them from the threats of the waterways. It just shows the importance of educating professionals, the public, engineers, and contractors about the benefits and successes of living shorelines as compared to these hardened approaches. A lot of people don't realize that their erosion not only comes from the tides, but also from upland runoff. With a barrier like a bulkhead, the tides can cause further erosion on the sides, and runoff water can collect and carve out areas behind the wall, eroding the backside of it. With a living shoreline, the stormwater would run off and the native components can filter out contaminants before they reach the aquatic environment. So the upland component is an important thing to consider when choosing a stabilization type. Another challenge is that any kind of bank stabilization project is going to be expensive, and there's no known funding opportunity to help property owners combat erosion on private properties. However, current cost estimates show that living shorelines are typically less expensive than bulkheads and usually require less long-term maintenance.
Okay, but what about people who have existing bulkheads? What are their options for either hybridizing or eventually creating a new living shoreline?
The important thing to remember is that living shorelines are not best for every situation. Georgia has a high tidal range that we need to take into consideration, and there are some properties that are located along high energy waterways. We haven't seen a living shoreline example in this kind of location in our state to see if it could establish while also being exposed to such high wave energy plus tides. But for those that are in low to medium energy environments, the Coastal Resources Division and several other agencies are encouraging the use of this nature-based solution. Imagine a tennis ball being thrown at a bulkhead. What's going to happen? It will bounce back quickly, right? The energy will dissipate. Now, imagine a tennis ball being thrown at a living shoreline. The ball will land and slowly roll down, and in the same way, the energy will be absorbed in a way that will cause less harm to the bank. In medium energy environments, engineers may design living shorelines to incorporate riprap along the toe or waterside bottom of the shoreline for extra protection against the waves and storm surge. For those with existing bulkheads, some may be interested in totally removing it to create a living shoreline, or some may be interested in removing a section and tying it into an existing structure. We've seen both examples in Georgia. First, a bulkhead was completely removed near the lodge on Little St. Simon's Island, and second, a section of a wooden bulkhead was removed and replaced on our most recent project, a demonstration site at DNR's Coastal Regional Headquarters in Brunswick, Georgia. Here, the living shoreline is tied into the wall on each side.
It's great to hear about some successful projects. What are some things you wished more people knew about living shorelines and other nature-based solutions?
First, I would want people to understand the power of plants. Many property owners have recently experienced more frequent high tide flooding events, and our recommendations to them often involve planting native vegetation along the upland to absorb a lot of the excess tidal water and storm water. Also, always remember to recycle your oyster shells. A lot of residents enjoy hosting or attending oyster roasts, and those shells can actually be reused for coastal projects like living shorelines or artificial reefs for fish habitat. There are recycling stations in several locations along the coast and even inland in Georgia and across the Southeast. I'm always spreading the word about the success that we have seen with living shorelines on our coastline and the importance of that natural connectivity between land and water for the resilience of our coastal communities. They provide a method to reduce erosion that protects infrastructure on the upland without a physical barrier to marsh migration and wildlife access. More information about native plants, oyster recycling, living shorelines in general, and what to do if you're interested in a living shoreline on your property can be found on CRD's Living Shoreline Story Map, which you're welcome to link on the show notes.
We will definitely share a link. That story map is awesome, and we hope to see it grow with all the new projects this episode will undoubtedly bring.
You mean from all our listeners, aka our parents?
Podcasts are deemed successful based on number of listens, not individual listeners, Brittany. And on that note, thanks for joining us again, Megan.
Thanks for having me, Synards.
So, Brittany, maybe after work we can head over to the new shellfish disco I heard about.
Oh, I don't know. Last time I went to one of those, I pulled a muscle.
Okay, well, instead we can go check out the new machine they developed that will pick litter up from the beach.
Oh, really? I've never seen one of those before.
Yeah, I saw one the other day. Unfortunately, it was malfunctioning and was grabbing shorebirds off the beach instead. I said, well, that took a turn. For more information about any of the topics we covered today, or to submit your question that may be featured in our upcoming episodes, please email us at signer.socials@gmail.com. That's signer.socials@gmail.com.
Thank you for listening to Sapelo Nerds, a coastal science podcast brought to you by the Sapelo Island National Estuarine Research Reserve.
Please check back for more episodes released each month. And we really need reviews. So, you know, leave us a couple of good ones. Really good ones.
And that's the Sapelo Sound.